With permission, Mr. Speaker, I would like to make a statement about recent naval engagements in the South Atlantic. Since its arrival in these waters...
The political scandal over the Belgrano starts with the government's decision to give a false account of the sinking during the war. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and the Ministry of Defence will spend the next 2.5 years misleading Parliament and trying to defend its version of events. They never come clean as such. Instead, the truth comes out slowly, torturously. To this day, there are still unanswered questions.
We regarded the Belgrano as a threat to our forces. And
the first discrepancy in the government's account emerges a month after the war, when HMS Conqueror returns to base at Faz Lane and Commander Chris Rayford Brown speaks to the waiting press corps.
I will admit that, proudly, that we sank the Belgrano. She was outside the TZ, as you rightly say, and I was under direct orders from Sink Fleet, and they were confirmed by me before I went in for my attack.
The commander of the submarine says that he was acting under orders from naval headquarters at Northwood. But this isn't what Defence Minister John Nott told Parliament in his statement during the war. He said that Rayford Brown acted of his own volition.
The actual decision to launch a torpedo was clearly a decision taken by the submarine commander. But that decision...
The contradiction passes everyone by, except for one man. The anti-war MP, Tam Dyel.
In the 5th of July, Commander Rayford Brown returns to the west coast of Scotland, hoists his Jolly Roger. He let the cat out of the bag. The commander of Conqueror vouchsafed that his orders to sink Belgrano came from Northwood.
It became Dyel's mission to establish a factually accurate account of what happened on May the 2nd. How, when, and why were all the decisions taken that led to the torpedoes? He was, shall we say, an enthusiast for the truth. Others said, a pest.
Is it the submarine commander, or is it the Prime Minister who is lying?
I think that the Honourable Gentleman mustn't use that word. I'm sure he would rephrase that final comment.
Is it the submarine commander or the Prime Minister who's telling the truth?
Tam Dyel was an old Etonian, a Labour backbencher and a serial troublemaker known for his consistently anti-war position, from Aden in the 1960s to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. As soon as the task force set sail for the Falklands, he started to call for it to turn around. And he always believed that the dispute over the islands could only be solved politically, not militarily. Dyel wrote 10 pieces on the Falklands for the London Review of Books, all of them scribbled on House of Commons notepaper. The magazine was one of the few places willing to publish dissenting voices over the war, and he was one of just a handful of MPs who opposed the conflict.
He was a very unlikely chap for a Labour MP. He lived in a baronial hall.
He hated Margaret Thatcher. He was pretty much a pacifist.
Somebody driven by a very profound sense of what was right and in the importance of ministers telling the truth to Parliament.
Without Tam Dyel, there would have been no Belgrano scandal. Under his intense scrutiny, the government's version of the sinking started to unravel, and he became convinced that there was something darker at play. But was the London Review right to give him so much column space? Many believed that he was a conspiracy theorist.
A lot of the stuff that Tam Dyel was going on about was just rubbish. It was just toilet paper. You know, the man was rambling.
No rational argument can convince somebody who believes in a conspiracy.
He was punching above his weight.
I'm Andrew O'Hagan, and from the London Review of Books, this is the Belgrano Diary.
Twice.
Episode 3, Small Lies, Big Lies. The Falklands campaign was Lieutenant Sethia's last as a naval officer. In the summer of 1982, as Tam Dale notices the discrepancy introduced by the captain of the Conqueror, Sethia is preparing for a new life outside the Royal Navy.
13th of July, 1982. Last night was my last run ashore in the Royal Navy. We all got very drunk, and the bear presented me with a clock, a plaque, and a thermometer. I had a little weep. I can't write much at present. My mind's in turmoil. But the skipper gave me a sherry.
I did not leave the RN because I did not like the RN. I did not leave it because I was dissatisfied with it in any way, or because of my experiences in the South Atlantic. But it was the yearning, the zest for travel that really took me. I wanted to see the world.
Sethia had actually handed in his resignation long before the war, and 2 weeks after returning to the UK, he's left the Navy and is planning a transatlantic sailing trip with his friend, Peter Bones. Their ultimate destination? The Caribbean.
8th of August, 1982. After 3 weeks of hardish work, we sailed from the Hamble today to the tumultuous sound of applause from 60 friends. We put up sails in Southampton water and off we went.
Sethia and his diary head back out to sea. This time, in a battered 30-foot yacht, barely fit for purpose. By November, he's crossing the Atlantic for the second time that year.
And we could see what looked like a torpedo coming on our starboard side, 10 feet off. I go into slow motion now. I say to Bones, get your fucking camera. It was a humpback whale, leapt out of the water and came down on his back. I mean, you're talking about a whale that was twice the length of our yacht and then going, bang, and the explosion of the sea. We got soaked in the cockpit.
The crossing takes them a month, and then they see on the horizon Carlisle Bay in Barbados.
10th of December, 1982. A great day. Sighted the lights of Barbados about 45 miles off. 3 hour wait for immigration and an $11 entrance fee. And got drunk.
Sethia finds work in St. Lucia, chartering yachts for well-heeled tourists. He thinks the Falklands and the Belgrano are all behind him.
A web and tissue of contradictions and misinformation is what we face. We need a tribunal to turn their immediate attention on the extent to which the decision to sink Belgrano was to do with the sobriquet of Iron Lady and illusions about ascertaining what metal the Prime Minister was made of.
After noticing the first discrepancy, Dale starts to scrutinise any new evidence that emerges. The problem for the government is that when anyone involved in the sinking speaks publicly about the events of May the 2nd, they contradict the official narrative. A few months after the war, the Sunday Times Insight team cites sources on the Conqueror who claim that the Belgrano was first detected at least 24 hours earlier than John Knott had stated. Argentinian sources say that the Belgrano was heading home when attacked. Dale zeroes in on these two further discrepancies, the date of detection and the direction of travel.
It was a classic example of where a politician starts to pull on a thread.
Robert Rogers, then a clerk in the table office.
It became clear that he was going to follow these issues about where the Belgrano was heading when she was torpedoed, whether there was information that could have allowed military commanders and so political oversight to know whether she was a threat to the task force or not. So Tam used questions very well, I think, to try and sift the wheat from the chaff.
Dyel's campaign to establish what really happened begins with a series of parliamentary questions. Robert Rogers has to make sure that these comply with the rules of the House. The first question comes at the end of November. It's a written one asking John Knott what course was the General Belgrano steering when she was torpedoed. Dyel gets a cagey and digressive answer, but in the final sentence, the government lets slip another inconsistency. They don't admit that the Belgrano had been sailing towards Argentina for 11 hours, but they do concede its bearing at the time of the attack.
By parliamentary question, it has been established that she was on a course of 280 degrees and is on a course for the Magellan Straits and her home port of Ushuaia in southern Argentina.
A course of 280 degrees. In other words, when the torpedoes were fired, the Belgrano was pointing away from the task force and towards Argentina.
So how are we to explain the Defence Secretary's statement, quote, this heavily armed surface attack was close to the total exclusion zone and was closing on elements of the task force, which was only hours away?
Dyel becomes even more suspicious. He follows up with a barrage of parliamentary questions.
I refer to questions 113 and 114.
Why should there be such discrepancies?
The course and speed of the Belgrano at the time of the attack.
How long continuously?
Which torpedoes were used?
Belgrano in her sight.
How, when and why were the rules of engagement changed?
Normally I would have accepted a senior officer's word unquestioningly. But then we live, don't we, in the age of misinformation.
And in the table office, we had an A4 ring binder, one of the very big ones. And when it became clear that Tam wasn't going to give up on this, rather than for all of us to try and remember what answers he had got to his questions, we would cut them out and stick them in this ring binder. We kept it as a sort of relic in the table office for a number of years. And it was an invaluable aid to us.
Dyel is a one-man pressure group. He demands a public inquiry, a tribunal, full disclosure. But after admitting that the Belgrano is facing away from the task force, the government simply pulls down the shutters. They refuse to answer any more questions or give any further details, repeatedly citing security concerns. Defence Minister John Knott.
I think I ought to say that a very, very large proportion of what he said is just totally and completely untrue.
The government benches start to question DL's sanity.
The Honourable Gentleman's behaviour in these matters begins to cast grave doubts on his mental stability, because he seems to have an obsession. He can come back to this as much as he likes, and I dare say he will, but he won't alter the facts. And the facts are as he's been given them.
Government is refusing to correct any of the inaccuracies in John Knott's original statement to Parliament. But why did it choose to give a false account in the first place? John Knott was drafting the statement as he drove from the Ministry of Defence to Parliament.
And he and I were in the back of the car, and the statement was on our knees, and he was still fiddling with the exact wording as we drove.
John Knott's private secretary during the war, David Ormand.
The key to that statement is that the reason the Belgrano had been sunk was because the rules of engagement had been changed. The reason the rules of engagement had been changed was because the fleet and Admiral Woodward were expecting an imminent attack, which we knew about from intercepted information. That intercepted information was top secret. So the hostile intent being shown by the Argentine fleet had to be conveyed to the House. But you couldn't say how we knew it. And that's where the phrase like sort of closing on elements of the task force that we were fiddling about with in the back of the car came from.
anybody would understand the need not to say things. What's harder in this particular situation to understand is the wish to say things, to say a number of things, some of which were untrue.
That comes back. Sorry to interrupt you. But that's the whole point of this statement. John wanted to say as much as he could to the House of Commons.
So he said more than he should.
Well, he said what his judgment had led him to believe the House ought to hear to justify this act. It was about how do you convey this essential truth that there was hostile intent without giving away information which your naval advisers are saying you mustn't give away.
David O'Mahond is referring to the Argentinian signals intercepted by GCHQ the day before the sinking. This intelligence suggested that Argentina had fallen for the British deception plan and believed that the task force was about to land on the islands. The Argentinians were planning a counter-offensive of their own on the morning of May the 2nd. This was subsequently called off, but according to O'Mahond, the inaccuracies in John Nott's statement were about communicating this hostile intent of the Argentinian fleet.
Now, the only mistake the government made was not simply correcting the record once the fact of the GCHQ interception no longer was so sensitive.
Perhaps John Nott's statement really was an attempt to convey an essential truth and protect intelligence sources during the war. But if that is the case, then what happens next is highly unusual. In December 1982, the government publishes a white paper on the lessons of the Falklands campaign. This is an opportunity to establish the facts now that the information is no longer operationally sensitive. But rather than correct any of the inaccuracies in John Nott's original statement, the government writes them into the official record of the war. As far as Dalziel is concerned, this is all starting to look like a cover-up.
The opening 10 words of paragraph 110 of the white paper encapsulate a highly significant inaccuracy. It reads, "On May the 2nd, HMS Conqueror detected the Argentine cruiser General Belgrano. Not according to my information, Mr. Deputy Speaker."
In the London Review, Dalziel argues that the Belgrano's date of detection is all important. If the ship was detected earlier than the government claimed, why was it not sunk immediately? For him, the delay completely undermines the idea that the Belgrano was a direct threat to the task force.
So the controversy was around one paragraph and in particular one sentence in this white paper, which was...
This is Richard Mortram. By the time of the white paper, he has replaced David O'Mahond as John Nott's private secretary.
And I've never been able to establish whether it wasn't changed in this white paper because there were genuine security concerns and therefore it was decided, don't let's change it because we don't want to get into it. Or it wasn't changed because, well, the civil service is reluctant to get into changing things if ministers have said them.
But the fact that it persisted and then later was, as it were, defended again and again, it becomes something else at that point. Can you see that?
Yes. The interesting question is why no one came forward and said, we could change this now. Do you want it changed? Instead, they stuck to it and put it in the white paper. And that then led some people to assume... one person in particular, if they keep repeating this, it must have a particular significance to it. And it didn't, in my view.
But if the government has nothing to hide, why not use the white paper as an opportunity to come clean?
So the Prime Minister some years later said, well, it was because we didn't want to give further information at the time, whatever. But my view was, this wasn't particularly sinister. It was, again... civil servants doing what sometimes is useful and sometimes isn't. They were sort of reconciling all the bits of paper.
Reconciling all the bits of paper. After the white paper is published, the story goes quiet. The government appears to have successfully parried Dalziel's attacks. He's got no proof, And this all looks like the latest obsession of an eccentric anti-war MP. Dalziel is an isolated figure, held at arm's length by his own party. It's not hard for the government to portray him as out of touch with reality, or worse, a traitor.
Well, the honourable gentleman must, of course, answer to history and to his conscience for his statements. His accusations, I believe, must have given comfort only to Britain's enemies.
The honourable gentleman cannot even get his facts right.
Trouble is that with people who have bees in their bonnet, they do tend to find themselves unable to see the wood for the trees.
I trust, too, that in future he'll stick to some harmless cause, like proving that Bacon wrote Shakespeare's plays, because the fact of the matter is, inside this house and outside, he's generally recognised as being as daft as a brush.
No one is taking DL seriously. But even so, he never stops asking questions. The more the government obfuscates, the more convinced he becomes that they must be hiding something. Underpinning DL's campaign is a deep mistrust of Thatcher's motives, a suspicion that she was never really interested in finding a diplomatic solution and determined instead to escalate the conflict at the first available opportunity. He writes in the London Review that, quote, "The facts might reveal Mrs. Thatcher in her true colours as a leader who spurned many chances of peace in favour of personal and political domestic objectives." Dalziel's critics are right. He is obsessed. But what lay behind that obsession?
This is almost as difficult as finding Seth's house in the Caribbean. Bit colder though.
I'm with my producer Richard in search of the house of the Bins, double N, a huge 17th century pile that overlooks the Firth of Forth, not far from Edinburgh. It is the ancestral home of Tam Dalziel.
Is this possible? I might be going up the wrong lane to the wrong posh house. Not for the first time in my life. Wait a minute. This doesn't look like the Bins. This looks like the Bin.
And there it is.
Oh my God, it's a proper castellated Walter Scott building.
Tam Dalziel died in 2017, but we've come to visit his wife of 54 years, Kathleen.
Hello, Kathleen.
Oh, hello, you're there.
Hello.
Hello, very nice to meet you. Come in. Gordon's so disappointed.
Kathleen married Tam on Boxing Day 1963.
Right.
It's freezing out there, but what a view.
Oh, it's fantastic. This, almost 360 degrees.
This is my first time at the Bins.
Her great-uncle was John Wheatley, a legendary figure in Scottish and British politics, a hero of Red Clydeside, and a minister in the first Labour government in the 1920s.
Is it on? Is there a wee green light?
The green light is flashed. So, Kathleen, try and give us a sense of Tam for people who are listening to this who are younger and perhaps didn't know Tam Dalziel. Who was he?
He was unusual in many ways, certainly to me. And I think probably it was my curiosity about him that, you know, really, I thought, this guy's interesting. You know, I was never bored. And when we were going to get married, he said, you know, "I don't promise you an easy life, but I promise you an interesting one." And he was right, absolutely right. But he had great curiosity, great energy, and he just went about things in a way that I thought very different from anyone else I'd ever come across.
Tell us, if you can, the story of 1982. Can you bring us right to that beginning point, if you like, Kathleen, and explain to us how he became so interested in what happened to the Belgrano?
It was because of the deception, basically, because he's quite a loyal guy to the country. You know, he really came from that, his mother and father, the whole empire business, and, you know, all of that. He was very respectful of the Queen and everything else. But I think it was the deception and the fact that people in power abuse power, for people to get away with telling lies that actually have caused people's deaths.
We have spoken to a number of highly placed civil servants from the time, and what many of them say is that they hugely respected Tamdiel, but they thought that he lost the plot over this.
That's how other people see it, and I accept that that is what it seemed like to them. The thing that really got him, I think, about it, was that Mrs. Thatcher gave the order for the Bergarn to be sunk when she knew that there was peace talks going on, and she knew that, and she didn't wait until the outcome of that, because she'd been the most unpopular prime minister before the Falklands, and that war, like with many other prime ministers, diverting people from the problems at home by, you know, going into patriotic mode.
I take solemn responsibility of charging the prime minister with a particular, specific war crime and high misdemeanor.
These peace talks Kathleen mentioned, as far as DL is concerned, this is the reason for the cover-up. All the small lies in the government's account of the sinking are designed to conceal a big lie, a conspiracy to torpedo a last-ditch peace plan. This was the theme of his pieces in the London Review.
Now, in my experience, small inaccuracies are often part of larger inaccuracies. Seemingly small lies are part of larger lies. Had a new factor entered into the calculation of the War Cabinet between the evening of May the 1st and May the 2nd, yes, there was indeed a new factor, and that new factor was knowledge of a genuine peace offer.
Remember what we told you about the US-led diplomacy in episode 1? Well, there's more to the story. After the collapse of Alexander Haig's peace plan, the Peruvians stepped into the breach. President Belondi Terry of Peru was negotiating on behalf of the Argentinians, Alexander Haig on behalf of the British, with Thatcher's Foreign Secretary Francis Pym by his side in Washington. The timing of the Peruvian proposals, initiated the day before the Belgrano was sunk, is what so obsessed DL.
Because I believe that the real threat to the Prime Minister was not a threat at that stage of the Belgrano and her escorts to the task force, but that it was this treaty which was to be bound in red leather.
In the winter of 1982, DL travels to Peru on a four-day fact-finding mission. He interviews President Belondi, who tells him that the peace plan was viable and that Thatcher knew about it.
The seven-point plan had been agreed between Haig and Belaunde the previous night. According to the Peruvians, a call came through in the early hours of Sunday from the Argentine capital. It was General Galtieri. He said that he accepted the Peruvian plan.
By the afternoon of May the 2nd, the Peruvians were so confident of a peace deal that they scheduled a press conference for later that evening. The big desk, flags and leather-bound treaty were all being assembled. And it's at this point, according to DL, that Thatcher made her move.
And indeed I assert that when Haig and Pitt phoned the Prime Minister with what they thought was peace, this Prime Minister did a horrific thing, that she phoned Northwood and said, sink the Belgrano.
Small lies must be part of big lies. DL's claims about the Peruvian peace initiative are greeted with scepticism in Parliament and beyond. Thatcher always claimed she didn't know about the plan until after the Belgrano was sunk, and it's unclear whether the deal, which was essentially a rehash of Al Haig's original proposals, really was viable.
Look, it is undoubtedly true that the sinking of the Belgrano also sank the peace initiative. That doesn't mean that the junta would have accepted the peace initiative. No decision had been made, and I think a decision would have been very difficult. These were not people who had much of a reverse gear, to be honest.
Isabel Hilton, who reported on the war for the Sunday Times from Argentina.
My problem with Tamdiel's campaign was that it was an assumption from the beginning that this had been a deliberate act on the part of Margaret Thatcher, and there was no way of standing that up. I'm just not sure that the conclusions that I think Tam reached very early on were sustainable. But he was a man who, you know, had very strong views and wasn't necessarily open to evidence.
Dalziel's theory about the Peruvian peace plan is controversial and only isolates him further. In the spring of 1983, he's getting nowhere. Public interest in the sinking is non-existent. He needs backup, a different voice, someone who can reach a wider audience.
Mrs. Diana Gould in our Bristol studio. Mrs. Gould, your question, please.
Diana Gould is a silver-haired teacher from Cirencester, a picture of English respectability, with a first-class degree in geography and a previous life working in the Women's Royal Naval Service. She's been following Dalziel's campaign, and in May 1983, when she hears that Thatcher will appear on the BBC talk show Nationwide, she writes in and asks to go on the show. Before the filming, Gould contacts Dalziel and he refers her to his relevant speeches.
Mrs. Thatcher, why, when the Belgrano, the Argentinian battleship, was outside the exclusion zone and actually sailing away from the Falklands, why did you give the orders to sink it?
But it was not sailing away from the Falklands. It was in an area which was a danger to our ships and to our people on them.
It was on a bearing of 280 and it was already west of the Falklands, so I'm sorry, but I cannot see how you can say it was not sailing away from the Falklands. When it was sunk.
It was a danger to our ships.
No, but you have just said at the beginning of your answer that it was not sailing away from the Falklands, and I'm asking you to correct that statement.
But it's within an area outside the exclusion zone, which I think what you are saying is sailing away.
Which way it was facing at the time, a danger to our ships. Mrs. Thatcher, I am saying that it was on a bearing 280, which is a bearing just north of west. It was already west of the Falklands, and therefore nobody with any imagination can put it sailing other than away from the Falklands.
Mrs.
Gould.
Mrs. Gould
is the perfect weapon for Dalziel, a completely plausible representative of Middle England. Not unlike Mrs. Thatcher, in fact. For more than 5 minutes, she keeps up the pressure on the Prime Minister, who begins to lose her cool.
I think it could only be in Britain that a Prime Minister was accused of sinking an enemy ship that was a danger to our Navy, when my main motive was to protect the boys in our Navy. That was my main motive, and I'm very proud of it.
Mrs. Gould,
having hammered away on the details about the ship's course, direction and location, Gould then brings up the Peruvian peace plan.
Giving those orders to sink the Belgrano when it was actually sailing away from our fleet and away from the Falklands was, in effect, sabotaging any possibility of any peace plan succeeding, and Mrs. Thatcher had 14 hours in which to consider the Peruvian peace plan that was being put forward to her.
Mrs. Thatcher.
One day, all of the facts in about 30 years' time will be published.
That is not good enough, Mrs. Thatcher.
Would you please let me answer?
In the green room after the show, Thatcher's husband Dennis snaps that she has been stitched up by the long-haired trots and woofters of the BBC.
Mrs. Thatcher would always have been rattled by someone who was quoting a great deal of detail. She dealt in detail herself, and on this occasion, Mrs. Gould was a match for her.
Lord Robin Butler, Margaret Thatcher's principal private secretary.
I joined her in the summer of 1982, after the war, and of course it was a moment of triumph for her, but it had also been a time of great emotion. People often think of Margaret Thatcher as hard. She felt very keenly the risk that she was putting the forces in. She felt very keenly the events of the war.
Very clearly she did. And one of the interesting things to me is the way that this whole business seemed to get under her skin. The miners' strike, for example, or, you know, the riots in Britain. There are many topics of importance
where one wouldn't say she seemed to be filled with emotion, but the Falklands was different in that respect.
It was a subject that went very deep with her. I think she would have been irritated with people who suggested that the decisions taken in the war were wrong. She wanted to be known that she wouldn't be knocked off course by pressures. And in fact, that was one of the great strengths of her administration.
Thatcher's tête-à-tête with Diana Gould is the moment the Belgrano story goes mainstream. She's now on tape, very publicly repeating the government's lies. But Diehl still has the same problem. No proof. The truth sometimes needs a helping hand.
2nd of June 1983. At the Tobago Keys with Simon and Daphne. A good trip so far. Pissed the previous evening and all ended up in the water after capsizing the dinghy. Off today to continue down the Grenadines to Carriacou.
This is where the story of Lieutenant Sethia's diary grows stranger. He didn't mean to be a whistleblower. He was, if you like, set up to be one. In the summer of 1983, as Gould and Thatcher clash on primetime TV, Sethia is enjoying life in the Caribbean and hosting the first friend from HMS Conqueror to pay him a visit.
My naval friend, Simon O'Keefe, his wife, Daphne, who I'd known for 2 or 3 years, got on extremely well with him. A very well-spoken, educated man with an impish sense of humour like myself. So I rather warmed to him. His main area of duty was actually as a mechanic at the back end of the control room where I was on duty. And we both liked a cigarette and that type of thing.
Simon O'Keefe is an unusual serviceman. For a start, he's a rating, which is where you usually find the working class lads. But his father is a well-known literary publisher.
It was at that stage that the ideas started formulating in my mind, not specifically of publish my diary, but of there's an amazing thing that happened. Surely it's worth writing about and publishing something.
Sethia is toying with the idea of writing a first-person account of his South Atlantic patrol. Public interest in the Falklands is riding high, and many veterans are starting to publish similar books.
And so I'd said to Simon O'Keefe, you know, perhaps you wouldn't mind showing this to your father. He's an experienced publisher, and he will know whether it's the sort of thing that a book could be based upon.
5th of June, 1983. Weather rather nasty, heavy squalls and much rain. An unnerving morning at Petit Martinique. Dragged and fell the anchor, and then had engine failure. Simon's mechanical knowledge a godsend.
This is the last entry Sethia writes before he sends his diary back to the UK with O'Keefe.
So he took the one copy back
to England?
He took
the original. I had no copies of it at all. He took the original diary, that was it.
Back to London?
Back to England, yes.
Simon O'Keefe is the next link in the diary's chain, but nobody's sure where to find him. There is a Facebook page we think may be his. The profile is full of misleading details. He apparently lives in Algiers, is a graduate of the University of Bangladesh, and can it be true that he studied comedy? After a bit of digging, we track him down to South London.
I think we're going the wrong direction.
We are. What number is it?
From the House of the Bins to Blackheath. O'Keefe lives in a wide street with nice semi-detached houses, like the imperturbable setting for 100 English sitcoms.
Hiya.
Hi, Simon. Hi, I'm Andrew.
Hi, Andrew.
Good to meet you. How are you doing?
Yeah.
O'Keefe's sitting room is straight out of a novel.
In here?
Shelves filled with multiple copies of books his father either published or collected.
Where are we all
sit? Do you want to sit next to Andrew?
And in front of them, busts of James Joyce and Patrick Kavanagh.
Do you know where all your books are? Because you'll be better than me if you do.
Well, yeah. I know the price of every single bloody one of them as well.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Simon is hanging together, just about. He is bedraggled, shall we say, not fresh out the box, but very smiley, with a grin that might be called wicked, if it wasn't so sinister.
My dad was a publisher.
Yes, I know. Very well-known publisher, wasn't he?
Very well-known.
Yeah. Hugh McDermott. Funnily enough, I was just reading Hugh McDermott this morning in the London Library. So your dad published him?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
His complete poems.
I know that volume, actually. I think I might
have that. I could actually make your day. I'm going to give you a copy of Hugh McDermott, yeah, Complete Works on handmade paper.
No.
Signed.
Fuck off.
Only that morning, I'd been reading an essay by the Scottish poet Hugh McDermott, and here was this oddity of a man offering me a rare signed copy of his collected poems.
It's not been cut and it hasn't been bound, but it is the collected poems of Hugh McDermott, and it's signed by Hugh McDermott. This is incredibly special.
That's all right. Keeping away and happy, wasn't it, from Scotland?
You know the way to a man's heart.
It's a bit wet, but no mind.
O'Keefe reminds me of Sethia, and I can see why they got on. They are both foul-mouthed, curious, irreverent.
What do you think of Seth?
I think he's brilliant. He's funny. I enjoyed his company. It's one of those, we'd both be arrested at the same time, same charge. Basically, he stuck up a finger to authority as well.
Was he quite a rogue?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably what the attraction was.
We settle down in the sitting room and start to discuss the diary.
Simon, I want to go to June 83 and just get this clear, because people have told different stories through the years. I just want to hear you tell us the story of that visit in June 83 where you were in St. Lucia and Seth gave you the diary.
Yeah. I mean, he gave me the diary and I started reading it. I thought, whoa, this is... Because we were told no one is to keep a diary, all records. A couple of people did.
You read it through in St. Lucia?
I read it through in St. Lucia.
All of it?
Yeah.
And in St. Lucia, did you talk then, after you'd read it, about the possibility of publication?
Of publishing, yeah. That was the idea.
Did you think your father would be interested in publishing it?
No, my father's poetry and Irish novels.
So just to be clear, Simon, you weren't offering it to your father with a view to him publishing it. You just wanted some advice.
At that age, I probably thought my dad was just a publisher, so books is a book.
You were handed the manuscript, you'd read it, and you travelled back to the UK. Tell us what happened when you got back to the UK.
I read it again, and I'm thinking, well, this is a hot potato.
So that implies that, Simon, that you knew that the War Cabinet and Margaret Thatcher had been lying to the public?
Yes, basically. The government was denying, and they were lying. So I made contact with Lord Binns.
You felt that Tamdiel was the man that you would contact with the diary because you felt he'd make best use of it?
Yes, basically. He was asking the right questions.
So tell me about that first phone call.
I said, I've got a diary from HMS Conqueror. Whoosh, I want to meet you.
That's what you said?
So quick, yeah.
Did you make an appointment to meet in London?
I met him at the BBC. He was giving an interview at the BBC.
So where did you go with him?
At the Commons. We jumped a cab while he was... He could go to the day, so... Forget all the padding out about, we all got pissed on so-and-so.
Straight to the 2nd of May.
Yeah,
The day of the sinking of the Belgrano.
The day, the course, the spot, not in the exclusion zone. And went into the House of Commons, went into the library. He just photocopied the whole lot. I said, it's not my diary. This is for your eyes only, basically.
What did that mean, Simon? Because for his eyes only would have been a naive assumption. Did you really believe that he would do nothing with it?
Yes.
You thought it would just help him privately in his argument?
I knew he would ask the questions because if you keep asking the questions, you know, was HMS Conqueror 4 degrees latitude this, that? No, the Conqueror was not latitude that, which means someone is lying. But he basically had the proof.
OK, so you gave him this proof. My second question is, would you have told him that you didn't have the permission of the author of the diary to show it to him?
I just said, he doesn't know I've done it, basically.
So you just told the truth?
I just told the truth.
So O'Keefe betrayed his friend's trust, but why? Why did he leak the diary?
When I got the diary in St Lucia, I knew what I had in my hand. I had dynamite, and I basically said, I know what I'm going to lob this into the... because I'm a shit stirrer, if you like. I wanted to see what would happen. You know, I couldn't resist the Machiavellian... You know, I think it was my duty. That's a good one, isn't it? It was my duty to let the world know.
O'Keefe's so slippery as an interviewee. It's hard to know when he's spinning us a yarn he thinks we want to hear and when he's playing it straight. He's just the sort of person who was quite common in the 80s. A laugh-maker, a rabble-rouser, but deep down, a person who found the spirit of the age unacceptable.
Everybody on the submarine knew he was sailing home. You know, the navigation chart is there. You know, the little pinprick of light. You know, there's our circle. 200, the exclusion zone, but it's over here. People are not happy about it now, in reflection.
And you happy about it now?
No, of course I'm not. I mean, I killed 300 people who shouldn't have been killed. That's basically what it is, who never had a bloody chance. Clunking old ship. Nah, they didn't have a chance. Thatcher wanted to... She had to sink something. I'm listening to our leaders basically just telling lies. That was all it was about. So I did not want to become part of that lie.
No regrets?
No. It had to be done.
It had to be done.
Margaret Hilda... Thatcher.
In the same summer that O'Keefe passes the diary to Dalziel, Thatcher wins the 1983 general election.
19,616. Well, Mrs. Thatcher's vote is down by 1,000.
We're all celebrating. Oh, yes, we're all celebrating.
The BBC broadcast her landslide victory to the nation, and Conservative Party members gather outside Downing Street to celebrate. The Falklands Factor delivers her the country.
Prime Minister's got a fantastic majority.
She's untouchable.
My life has been put in danger by a government that had lied to everybody. And they're covering it up, basically. So I'm going to do something about it. Bring Thatcher down. Bring Thatcher down. Little old me could bring down a government.
Next time on the Belgrano Diary.
Heseltine called me up and he said, I want you to go through the whole thing. I want to be sure there isn't a Watergate in this somewhere.
My God, read this. It's my diary. This is what I wrote. And it's on the front page of today's newspaper.
And it was important for ministers to then try and put him in jail for saying this terrible thing, which was threatened their whole political position.
I got a phone call saying, you are to report to Naval Intelligence Headquarters Northwood in uniform.
Ours have not been the actions of people engaged in a hole-in-the-corner cover-up in an attempt to mislead this House.
The Belgrano Diary is a production from the documentary team at the London Review of Books. If you liked this episode, please leave a rating and a review wherever you listened. This helps other listeners find the show. Episode 4, The Crown Jewels, will be available next Thursday, April the 18th. You don't need to wait to listen to the rest of this series. If you click on the link in the show notes, you can access all the episodes right now, as well as hours of extended interviews. You can read a collection of the magazine's coverage of the Falklands War and the politics of the early 1980s on our website. There's a link to this in the show notes, where you will also find a list of the archival audio used in this episode. The series producer was Richard Curling. Ben Walker was the producer, and Zach Brophy, the story editor. Original music and sound design by Joel Cox. I'm Andrew O'Hagan.